Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of The House of Mystery is brought to you by Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. LegacyFoodStorage.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your host, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren, and in the co-pilot chair, we've got Mr. David Martino.
I am here.
Thanks for having me, Al. Yeah. Somebody's got to do this, you know.
That's right.
I'm having a struggle here, so I'm just like, my God. Anyway, so another great show today, and follow-up to Mr. Dean Koontz. So today we are talking in suspense thriller and with Mr. Paul Vidick. Thank you for being here, Paul.
Thank you for having me. And it's great to follow Dean Koontz.
Yeah. Now, Paul, last time we had you on, you were doing The Coldest Warrior, which was great. I loved that book. I loved the show that I saw about it. Now you've got a new book called The Matchmaker. And there's a spy in Berlin, and it's out February 1st here. So let's talk about the premise of the book a little bit. Like, what is the storyline?
The storyline is there's a young woman, an American, who's a translator, who finds herself living in Berlin in 1989, and she's married to an East German. She had a bad marriage and then met this, you know, handsome, young, charming East German who was a piano tuner. And they marry, and the opening of the book, the first chapter, she's waiting for him to return from a business trip to Vienna. And he's late, and there's a knock on the door. She answers it, and it's not her husband. It's an American from the embassy, who says that her husband is missing. And it quickly comes to pass that he's thought to be drowned. And from that death unfold a whole series of revelations around who the husband really is, what he had been doing. And I won't spoil the book, but it's a series of sort of unwrapping the mysteries that, you know, lead to a whole series of thriller-like events and moments between the Stasi, the East German spies, the American CIA, and this young woman who finds herself, to some extent, caught up in the intrigues of others and has to discover the answer to, the mystery of her husband in order to get off the hook herself.
I noticed that, okay, so you really like the Cold War and that sort of timing and Berlin Wall falling and stuff like that. Is there something personal to you about that, or is it just something you're really interested in?
Well, I grew up as a child in the Cold War, as we all did, or many of us did, and it was this dark shadow over our lives. The Soviet Union was a nuclear threat, and I remember as a child we would be asked to do bomb drills where you hide under your desk at school with the idea that somehow that would protect you from a nuclear blast. But it was this shadow, and it was Kennedy at the Berlin Wall. It was Nikita Khrushchev, pounding his shoe at the UN. And then what happened in the course of the 80s is that the behemoth, this threat, the Soviet Union, sort of crumbled and collapsed on its own. And that was a remarkable event, to have this threat that you lived with, for 50 years suddenly dissipate, vanish. And the irony today is that with Putin and the Ukraine, we're sort of reliving some of that anxiety. But in any case, the Cold War was, helped shape my view of the world as a young man. And that's what's drawn me back to that period in time.
And when we talk about some of the things like, MK Ultra or anything like that, what's your thoughts on that? Because right now, in today's date, there's a lot of people that think that it's not true, it never happened, and that's probably because of all the conspiracies and that really kind of take it out of proportion, because every time something happens in the country, it was MK Ultra, or it's a code word, like Hillary called them on the phone and he shot everyone. Like I hear all these things, and I think so. There's kind of a disbelief in this sort of thing. Where do you stand in that?
Well, we live in a world where there's social media accelerates and expands upon rumors and myths and misinformation. I think it's incumbent upon anybody who wants to dig into things to try and get, a historical version of what might have happened in the CIA in the 50s. And MK Ultra was in fact a program that was developed by the United States. A guy named Sidney Gottlieb was in charge of it. And it grew out of the paranoias of the 1950s. One of the paranoias was that the Soviet Union had developed various different drug programs that would allow it to basically kidnap American personnel, either military or political, drug them, and then take from them the secrets that would in some ways jeopardize the United States. So MK Ultra was sort of our reaction to the fear that that was a program that the Soviets were doing. And it was basically testing drugs that were truth-telling in either witting or unwitting individuals. But the history of MK Ultra, is there available to be read. And it really was a product. It was a product of that time.
Well, is Hillary Clinton using it now, or?
I don't know what Hillary is doing. I haven't heard much about her since she lost the election many years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just kind of, there's just a lot of people that talk in this area. Where do you come up with storyline behind something like this in this setting of the Cold War?
Well, I decided I want to set the novel in Berlin. Partly Berlin, through a 50-year period of time, basically from Kristallnacht, which is in 1938, I believe, up until the fall of the wall, was the one place where the East and West met in the Cold War conflict. And there were spies running around on both sides, and Berlin was sort of the well that, from which people sort of were taking their secrets. Khrushchev called Berlin the swampland of spies. So I was drawn to it for that same reason that many other writers are drawn to it. It was a place where the intersection of East and West, the Warsaw Pact and NATO. And in the course of my research, I came across the autobiography of Marcus Wolf, who was the head of counterintelligence for Stasi, which was the East German secret agency. And he was a brilliant guy in many respects, highly regarded by his adversaries in, MI6 and the CIA. And he developed a form of, what we'll call lovecraft as opposed to tradecraft. The honeypots and, different ways in which sex is used to undermine spies has always been a part of intelligence services. But he took that one step further. And he made lovecraft into tradecraft. And what he did was trained young East German men to move to the West to find vulnerable young women who had positions in government agencies, potentially with access to secrets, to romance them, to find out where they were vulnerable. Some of them were vulnerable because they had drinking problems or money problems or love problems. And they groomed these young women and in many cases married these young women. And these young women then became their covers for their covert activity in West Germany. And in some cases, after the GDR fell, these women discovered for the first time that the man that they had been married to for 5 years or 10 years was an East German spy. And you can imagine that's a pretty terrible thing to discover about somebody that you were married to, that you thought you loved, and suddenly the deception is revealed. That to me was an interesting premise for a story. The woman who discovers her husband is an East German spy who has another family in East Germany, a son, a wife. Well, how do you deal with that? And can you love somebody who's deceived you, betrayed you in that way? And that was my interest. I was really interested in this woman, Ann Simpson, and how she would deal with this discovery.
Well, how do you get into her head then? How do you get into how she would do it? Because the time frame, too, being years ago, and how someone would be living and thinking, how do you find yourself getting into that character?
I'd never written a novel from a woman's point of view before, but obviously this novel had to be written from a woman's point of view. And I have understood, being a reader of a lot of wonderful books, that books aren't really written, based on gender. To give you an example, Wuthering Heights, which is a brilliant book with this wonderful male character, Heathcliff, was written by a young woman. And Anna Karenina, a wonderful woman, fictional character, was written by a middle-aged Russian. So, the question becomes, how does anybody put their, create a character that may be of the opposite gender and give them, that breathe life into who they are? And in my case, I looked at her motivations, and I looked at the situation she was in and her fears and her, you know, needs. And I began to shape that person around that, the context that she was in, the demands that were being placed on her, and found in her somebody who had discovered her own, what I'll call agency, her own, you know, courage to confront the men around her who were trying to, you know, push her in one way or another way. And so she evolved in my mind from somebody who was a victim to somebody who becomes a dispenser of justice in the very end. But again, it was just looking at, you know, the basic qualities of character, who you are, what you, how do you react to a situation? And in some ways you pull those emotions out of your own background, or you pull it, in my case, out of, you know, to some extent, my wife. Subtle influence on all of my work.
Well, to go a little deeper, do you have, when you're writing your characters, do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear your characters in your mind? Are you transcribing? Is that how that works for you?
There comes a point, I do a lot of outlining. I spend, you know, 6 months of research outlining. I create dossiers on the characters, and I try to understand the world that I'm about to embark on. And then I begin to write. And what I discover is that, notwithstanding all the stuff that I had done, all the research, all the dossiers I've written, that at some point in the writing, the character begins to take over. The character begins to guide where the story is going to go. Because at each point, inflection point, the character has to do one thing or a different thing. And obviously, I'm there, the pen is in my hands, but the character is in my head, and I am imagining where that character needs to go in order to be, you know, truthful to who that person is. And so it is definitely, you know, allowing a character to sort of emerge and take hold of the story that is being told.
Well, in that vein, have you ever had a character do something that surprised you, kind of just went their own way, didn't want to go along with the outline or the plot? Has that ever happened?
I wouldn't say so much that the character rebelled against the plot. That hasn't happened. But there have been moments where the character has done something that surprised me. So in this novel, there's a moment in time where the woman, Ann Simpson, is at the river, and they're looking for her husband's body. And there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Knapp, who's sort of a nattily dressed older man, doctor, who she finds offensive. He wears a toupee. And, you know, the line is that his character is as false as the hair on his head. And at one point, as she's looking at him, she says to her, she wants to take, you know, a handful of dirt, mud, and basically rub it into his jacket, because she can't stand the fact that he is so, you know, properly dressed, but yet repulsive. So that act, although she doesn't do that, she doesn't do it, she has the instinct to do it, that came out of that moment where this young woman, Ann Simpson, is having a revulsive reaction to this character. And it wasn't, you know, that just happened. And that's the sort of surprise that is interesting, because it's basically, you know, the way that we all are. You know, we don't go around our day planning every single moment. We encounter things on the street or in the car or in the home, and we react. Mm-hmm. And that's the fun, allowing a character to breathe, you know, and be serendipitous.
Do you put kind of a subtext, or do you have something that you want people to get out of this book besides the actual storyline?
Well, yeah, I like to say, like Isaac Singer said that, you know, a book needs to both entertain and to instruct. And so the story, the characters, I hope are entertaining. I hope people enjoy the book. But there's also message is probably too heavy a way to describe it. But I want people to come away and think about some of the things that go on in the book. And in this case, the theme is justice. You know, this young woman is a victim and her husband becomes a victim. And the CIA decide that this Marcus Wolf-like character, who's the head of Stasi counterintelligence, who is a terrible man, they decide that he should avoid prison, should avoid prosecution, because he has secrets that the U.S. could use, specifically about some old and cold cases. So rather than have him prosecuted, they decide they want to invite him to the U.S. To become a part of the agency and to provide the agency with some of the intelligence it's looking for. And she's offended by that, offended that somebody so terrible will be let off the hook. And she decides to act on her own and mete out her own form of justice. It really isn't that different than what happened after World War II. Many of the Japanese bioweapons scientists, who were basically war criminals, were invited to the United States so their intelligence about bioweapons could be used in our own bioweapons programs. And the same was true with Nazi scientists, you know, who avoided war criminal trials because their intelligence, was of interest to the United States military. And so I like to have characters live in this sort of gray world where the line between right and wrong is very ambiguous.
How bad were you going to make the husband in a story like this? Like,
how bad?
Yeah, like, you know, is he like this major killer and awful person?
But the husband isn't so bad. I mean, he's got his own issues. He's a faithful to his son and his wife, and he's trying to escape from the East Germany, and he, you know, is using this woman, Ann Simpson, for his own purposes. So I think all of the characters are, ambiguous, have morally ambiguous intentions. And to me, that's the way the world is. It's very rare that you have somebody who is, an evil person who doesn't have some sort of redeeming quality or somebody who claims to be, a priest who doesn't have some underlying corruption. It's the nature of humanity. It's the nature in all of us. And that, to me, is the exciting thing about, writing spy novels. You're operating in a world where these contradictions are a part of the world they live in.
So you think that the Cold War never really ended?
Well, the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the West ended, but the hostilities between authoritarian regimes like Russia today and democracies like England and the United States hasn't ended. That's the tension we feel, I think, in the world right now.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of strange. It almost has the feel of the Cold War, but
it definitely more so. I mean, we went through a period after 2001 where the Cold War seemed to vanish, and what we had was the War on Terror, and the War on Terror you know, still with us, but the adversarial relationship between this Russia and its satellites and the West, obviously, right now, as we're speaking today, is at a peak. And, you know, it's amazing to even think that, you know, all the news is about the drumbeats of war in the Ukraine, because that feels exactly like, you know, Czechoslovakia in 1956, Cuba in 1959.
Yeah. Canada, 2022. A little joke. You seem to be going into the spy novels a lot. Is this something you're going to continue to do?
I really enjoy the characters who, you know, live in that world, and I feel like there's a lot more. Many more stories that I can tell. I mean, there's one that is my next novel, which is pretty much done. Not the one that we're talking about now, which is going to be published next week, but one that I'm just writing. And it's set in Beirut in 2006 during the 34-day war between Israel and Hezbollah. And it's so the novel is really about the war on terror. But it's a fascinating moment. A woman who happens to be what they call non-official cover. So she's an agent, but she's not associated with the CIA. So she doesn't get any of the benefits, like diplomatic immunity if she's caught. So that, you know, that to me, the Middle East is a ripe ground for, you know, for more stories about, you know, spies, basically.
Well, you know, you're writing a lot about secrets and very dark things. Does that affect you when you're not writing? And do you need to, you know, relax and recharge, find a way to kind of get away from that when either in between novels or in between chapters?
No, not. It's true. I do write about dark things, but but that is the world we're in. You know, it's so I'm just trying to reflect on sort of the real world we're in, and in some ways, it's nice to be in that sort of controlled world because the world of today, America today, with all of its problems, is actually darker than my dark novels. So I and one of the things that I do, which I enjoy doing, is I introduce a lot of humor into the book, but it's subtle. It isn't like guffaw humor, but it's characters who are clown-like or it's jokes, because in the nature of the pacing of a book like mine, you've got to lighten up the reader. They've got to be able to feel that, you know, the pacing isn't all tense and extreme.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I introduce different characters, like this character, Dr. Knapp. He's sort of an oddball character, but, you know, I think people will enjoy him and what he says simply because he's an interesting character. I mean, if you look at some of Shakespeare's, you know, darkest tragedies, Hamlet, for example. Hamlet's a novel in which there are 8 killings. Everyone is dead at the end, you know, it's about as grim as you can get. But, you know, there's the scene with Polonius, you know, and he's a funny character. And so he introduces a lot of wit and humor into a grim story. And then there's the gravedigger. And the grave digging scene, just hilarious if you stop to think about it, and the and that is important for the pacing of the play. So I think one of the things that I enjoy doing is finding ways to insert comedy or clown like characters into the novel to, you know, allow the pacing of the novel to proceed. And the suspense to sort of, you know, continue.
So who do you use as an influence? Are there other spy writers that you like?
Yes, there are a number that I, obviously I'm a big fan of Jean Le Carré, a big fan of Graham Greene, Eric Ambler. Those are sort of classical writers. Of the contemporary authors, I'm a big fan of Joe Cannon, who is a friend, and he's just a wonderful writer. There's Charles Cumming, who is a wonderful English writer, and there's a young writer, an American, by the name of David McCluskey, who has one novel out called Damascus Station, which is a wonderful novel, and I think he will do very well. And it's interesting, one of the novelists that I think of as the sort of the classic spy novelists are all, for the most part, all English, because the spy novel has a much longer tradition in England than it does in the United States. And that's partly because, you know, we didn't actually have a Secret Service until 1947 when the CIA was created. And before then, we were pretty much, you know, a country that didn't live beyond the boundaries of, you know, the East and West Coast. Whereas England was an imperial nation and had India, it had its, you know, troops pretty much everywhere. And, you know, intelligence is really about gathering information to support, you know, national security decisions by the president or the prime minister. And we didn't have those issues for the most part. So it was only, so, you know, the classic spy novelists are for the most part English. And it was only probably in the mid to late 60s that we had our first real spy novels that is of literary quality. And of course, now there are many more. But it's, you know, when you think about the tradition of writing in the genre, it's quite different in the UK than it is here.
And I was wondering, you know, you made the switch from, you know, being a very successful senior executive in the entertainment industry to writing books. What recommendations would you give someone who's looking to pursue their passion full time?
It takes a lot of work, and you don't just pick up and do it. I would say I was a writer before I was a business executive. It's just that I put my writing on hold in order to have a family and earn an income and do all the things you need to do. And it was only after I was able to financially be independent that I sort of said, I'll go back to being the writer I thought I wanted to be. So writing is a calling. It's work, but to put up with all the things that it requires, I think it really needs to be a calling.
Absolutely.
And there are people who, you know, many writers, well-known writers who started writing in their, you know, mid-40s, 50s. In my case, I left my job when I was 58, and I've produced now, this is my fifth with the other one that's been written six books in like 8 years. Mm. And that's a lot of work.
Oh, it certainly is.
Well, you got to get cracking. You got to do more.
I know.
What do you think of the new world of publishing, you know, with Amazon and all of the different things out there and the internet, stuff like that? Do you like it, or do you sort of not like it, or where you stand?
Well, as for music, you know, that's probably music and movies more than books have changed an individual's relationship to either the sound or the picture. And it used to be, you'd buy a physical disc and you'd have to buy 12 songs and he only wanted one of them. So then, you know, and I was the one who did the deal with Steve Jobs, where we said, well, let's allow them to buy singles for 99 cents. And then they'll own the signal and listen to it. And then what's happened since then is we've gone from, you know, the album to the single, now to the stream, to the listen. We're down at that atomic level. And that's a wonderful thing for consumers. And as it's turned out, it's become a very profitable business for the music companies. And it's changed the way that we listen. And I think it's made it more convenient. You know, for the most part, technology works because it changes your life for the better. And I think people would say that having instant access wherever they are on their phone to whatever music they want to listen to was a good thing. And I think, you know, the same is true with movies. You think about how we can now watch movies at home, high quality movies, not just US broadcast shows, but, you know, 5% from France, all the wonderful Israeli and South Korean movies that are now available to us. That's a sort of revolution in taste and in convenience, and has, you know, created all sorts of opportunities for the creative community. Books is a little different because reading a book on your Kindle isn't quite the same as having a physical copy of the book in your hands and thumbing it. There's an aesthetic object, the book, which people still enjoy. And so I think in the publishing business, you know, the Amazons of the world have made it a little more difficult for the publishers, because Amazon is the one big behemoth on the distribution chain for ebooks. But I think, you know, the essence is that people like to read stories, and writers enjoy writing those stories. And I don't think that has changed.
What is your writing structure? So when you sit down to do something like this, how long does it take you? And are you the type of person that can set aside hours and just go, okay, I'm going to write, you know, 9 to 5 today and just do it? Or do you have to be in a certain mood?
I went to the office every day for, I don't know, 22, 24 years. And that regime, you know, taught me a work ethic, which is the work ethic that I apply to my writing. You know, I wake up every morning and start writing sometime between 7:30 and 8:30. And I work for 4 or 5 hours. Sometimes I get a lot done. Sometimes I get very little done. Sometimes I like what I did and sometimes I don't. But it doesn't really matter because it's the constant application of my effort that ends up in, you know, a novel, you know, 12 or 14 months after I begin it. Typically, I start with 6 months of research and then I do a first draft by hand in the notebook with the same Mont Blanc pen that I've used in each of the novels. And it's right here, in fact, I'm holding it. And then I do another draft and another draft. I usually do 3 or 4 handwritten drafts. And then the last draft is one that I type into the computer. And in each of those, the drafts get better, the language gets better, the pacing gets better, the characters deepen. And when I feel like I have something that is typed and pretty complete, of course, I think it's 95% complete at that point, but it's probably only 80% complete. My wife reads it, and then some other people read it. My agent reads it, and then they give me feedback, and that leads to a series of changes, edits, and so it's I would say probably 12 to 14 months from the start of a project to the end, which is pretty fast actually, but that's because I do it 4 or 5 hours a day.
Yeah, you have to put in a lot of time, right, to make it work. You know,
it's the 10, you know, you figure out how many hours, if you do something for 5 hours a day for 12 months, it's whatever that is, it's about 2000 hours, a little less than 2000 hours. It takes that long and there's no real shortcut. The thing I would say to people who think they want to write is that what's most important is patience. You can't rush a story. You can't rush a character. You know, you have to continue with them and you have to let those characters and those stories emerge so that they feel authentic. They feel real. So they feel like there's some truth, you know, that is on the page that entertains and instructs.
When you do your research, do you like to go to the country that you're writing in? Or I guess it's tough with COVID, but on a regular basis, do you?
Well, I have sort of a complicated view of that. You know, I sort of think I should, but then when I wrote the last book, The Mercenary, it was set in Moscow in 1985. And I'd hoped to go to Moscow, but COVID hit and we weren't able to go. And so I had to make do with not having been there. And I did a huge amount of research on Moscow, read a lot of books, looked at a lot of maps. And also I used Google Maps, which with its street view now allows you to walk down a street and look up and look sideways. And you can basically be in Moscow at a point in time. And for me, the Moscow I was creating was not, you know, a travelogue in Moscow. It was a setting in which my characters lived in a particular place, traveled a certain street to another, you know, to the embassy. There was a safe house. So all I really had to do was create an authentic world that my characters lived in. And I think I know that when the reviews came out, everyone commented on how authentic it felt. And I, of course, said, well, that's great because I've never been there. But if I could pull that off, then, you know, wonderful. And as part of that, I did have the benefit of there was a guy named John Barrowley, Ambassador John Barrowley. He was the first American ambassador to the Russian Federation. And he had been in Russia in 1985 in the embassy. And he very graciously read my book. And he made a number of comments about it, improving it a number of, you know, small but important ways. So it's important if you're going to do something where, in my case, I hadn't been there, to get somebody who has been there and have them, you know, point out the errors, because you're always going to make mistakes.
Yeah, and I guess it would be that way about the culture as well, because there's going to be even subtle differences in the way their manners are, the way they talk to each other and behave in other countries.
Yeah, and in that case, what I did is I read the autobiographies of a number of Soviet spies who defected, and I was able to pick up their speech patterns, their thought patterns, and that became a really important part of the book, because in my case, I had a double agent who was, you know, trying to exfiltrate a Soviet general. And so I had to sort of present this Soviet general. And it was, the autobiographies gave me a lot of insight into that character that I was able to then incorporate into the book.
Yeah, it makes for an interesting story. You can go that way. Maybe you'll get a movie made out of it.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, you could have like James Bond, you know, something, but better. So if you had one book, if no one has heard of you, which I don't see, and if they haven't read any of your books, which book would you tell them to read?
The most recent.
Okay, do you think you get, well, of course, do you think each book you get to be a better writer? Does it come across that way, do you think?
Every book is really hard. You have to push yourself hard. You can't allow yourself to coast. And it's, you know, there's always the impulse to say I'm done when you're not done. I would say this, the book that's out there now has some very subtle character development that I think is wonderful. And I think it will appeal to a lot of people for that reason. But it's also a very interesting and sort of, I'll call it, cleverly plotted book. And that I think is also makes it enjoyable. Some people have said, oh, it's your best book, and that you keep getting better. And of course, I love to hear that, because we're always as good, only as good as our last book. Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, I like all my books, and they're different. When I look at how people on Amazon and other places rate them, the one, The Mercenary, the last one, is probably the highest rated, and we'll see what happens with this one. But it's always a matter of taste. You know, one person, I had one interesting email from this came in about a year ago, where the person had read my first two books. And he sent me, and then he was reading the third book, The Coldest Warrior, and his email was, and let me just read this. He said, "Sir, I'm very much enjoying The Coldest Warrior. Please keep this up and do not return to the style of your first two books. I still don't know why I finished them, even speed reading. Your hero seemed to do nothing but sit around enjoying his gloomy self." So, you know,
yeah,
I got that. And of course I laughed. But obviously, you know, he was reading the third book, the third book came out, and he liked it. And that was the only thing that mattered to me at the time.
Mm. Do you like the way it is with social media and the interaction and stuff like that? Do you like to do that with readers?
For the most part, it's sort of like Twitter is a one-to-many. I don't usually get inbound communication on Twitter or Facebook, but people do write me notes on my website, and And some of them, you know, very moving, you know, communication. People who liked the book, who enjoyed a character, felt, you know, something worked for them personally. Or, you know, as this has happened to me twice, because I do happen to deal with guns and some military elements, people will point out where I'm wrong. And in one case, in The Coldest Warrior, I gave the principal character a Glock 19, and this was 1975. And the writer corrected me. And he said, well, the Glock wasn't invented until 1982. So you have that wrong. And if you're going to do historical fiction like I do, you have to try and make sure you don't make a mistake like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because someone out there will read it that will be looking for something like that and will make sure you know.
Yes, exactly.
So what is your website so people, listeners, can know where to find you?
It's paulvidich.com, paulvidich.com.
Great. Of course, we'll have that up on our websites as well, so they'll be able to find you with one click, you know, in case they can't remember. So right. How was COVID for you during, I it cut you off from traveling and that, but just the stress going around in the country and the, you know, the COVID and all the weird stuff going on, does that sort of shut you down in writing or make it harder for you to write?
No, I have an ability to sort of put my mind in a place, which is what I've done for the last 2 years. So I've written two books over those 2 years. So it hasn't had an effect on my writing, either the amount of writing or even what I'm writing about. Obviously it's been a very stressful 2 years for, you know, on the level of, you know, can we see our grandchildren? You know, are we able to travel to Rome once a year, which is what we used to do? And in those, you know, in each of those cases, the answer has been it's hard to see your family without feeling, you know, that you're in jeopardy. Certainly the holidays. But I do think it's a stressful time in America right now. And it's... And I'm hopeful that we will move on and, you know, return to some level of normalcy. But it is stressful for sure.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, maybe with Russia doing what they do, maybe that'll draw people together somewhat.
Well, as they say, a good war will distract everyone.
Certainly will, you know. That certainly will. Are you a spy yourself? Is this why you write about spies? Is this?
No, I was never a spy. I was never recruited to be a spy. I never aspired to be a spy, although I was in the CIA building once as a reporter. I was drawn to this area of fiction because I had an uncle. And I think we mentioned this on the last, when I was on your show the last time, who had been in the CIA. He was a bioweapons scientist who was murdered by the CIA and sort of a very dark episode. And I was curious about him and, you know, the loneliness of somebody who was doing secret work that he couldn't discuss with his wife and couldn't share his doubts about his work with his colleagues without seeming to betray the trust of those colleagues. And that character became an interesting character for me. And that's how I got into the space. And frankly, it's a little bit like Graham Greene or Le Carré. They don't write it. They use spies in their stories, but they really are love stories or they're stories about betrayal and trust. And it so happens that, or a particular class of Englishmen, but it so happens that the guardrails of their fiction are the guardrails of espionage literature.
Wow. That's interesting you say that. So is it your intention to start out writing kind of a love story or something and build it around a situation?
Well, the love stories are in each of the books. And they're the emotional bonds between men and women or men and men are important to the novels, but they don't really, they're not the story. They're not what I'll call the triggering event. In Shakespeare, the triggering event in Hamlet is when old Hamlet, the ghost, says to young Hamlet, "Revenge my murder." And that sets in motion all of the events of the play. And in my case, in each of my novels, there's a triggering event at the beginning, which sort of shapes the arc of the novel. And then within that arc, there are all these things going on between characters. It could be a love story, you know, various different things that are the complications that make the story rich. But there is an arc that's defined by a plot. And then within it, there are all of these, you know, subplots and stories, love stories or otherwise.
Boy, see, you're a real writer. I wished I could do that. Now, your last book, how was the response that you got from The Coldest Warrior and the story, not The Mercenary, but The Coldest Warrior, I guess a couple books ago, and your uncle and that? How do you think people responded to that?
I think they responded well to it. I think a lot of people liked it. There were people who sent me emails saying, you know, they'd had people, family members who took place in Fort Detrick who were there, and they sort of understood what was going on at that time. You know, it got starred reviews. It was well received critically. I think there's, people like to be entertained, and there's a tradition of movies and novels in which some character, little character, big character, a little bit like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, in which, you know, the little guy fights the corrupt big bureaucracy. and the novel The Coldest Warrior is a little bit of that, you know, and that's always an entertaining story.
Oh yeah,
but it's also that happens all the time, you know. It's that's what Washington is all about.
That's the repeating story.
It's a repeating story, you know. There's nothing. The only thing constant in Washington is sort of the amorality of the politicians and of the bureaucrats.
Oh, I'll say, never ends. But you know, that's what we've got. So, well, it's always an interesting conversation having you on. We really appreciate it. Now, the book you are going to buy is called The Matchmaker, and there's a spy in Berlin, and the author was our guest, Paul Wittig. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Very enjoyable. I'm happy to have been your guest.
Thanks, Paul.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.